For our sense of place visit to Detroit, we thought we would begin with one of the biggest recent stars out of the city, Jack White and the White Stripes, and a vintage cafe from 2003. At the time, the album Elephant had just been a huge record for the band with the hit Seven Nation Army. I'm going to start off with the difficult question that is probably you think about in some form every day, which is sort of, why us, why now, and can you ever be prepared for the attention that comes with this kind of success and keep your integrity? Do you think about that?
Well, that's funny. That's a popular question to ask us, I guess. I don't know. It's okay because I think that, you know, we had done so much at the beginning where we just had toured and played in front of, you know, five people in Cleveland or whatever for a long time, and we'd made lots of records. And even at that point there, it was success to us because we didn't have a day job anymore. We were just touring and making records. So that was sort of success to us because anything after that was sort of gravy on the potatoes, you know.
Right.
After a while, I mean, it became mainstream or whatever attention on the band, which was fine with us because it was just another thing that we hadn't experienced before. And we never changed our attitude to what we were doing. You know, we never stopped and reconsidered what was going on. And like, how can we maintain this? Or what's the next step we should do to maintain this and to become more popular or sell more records or whatever? We just always made, I think, Elephant, the last record. It seems to me to be pretty sure that that record would still have been made, you know, whether there was anybody liking us any more than the first album, you know.
I think that maybe part of the appeal is that people can sense that you're just doing what you do. And so much is, you know, today is kind of manufactured that I think that's part of the appeal. So I guess you kind of anticipated my next question was what your expectations were right at the beginning. Were there anything beyond, hey, you know, when you sat down with Meg for the first time, this sounds great. I mean...
Yeah, I think we assumed that the type of music we were making, we just assumed that it would have a limited appeal from the get-go, and that sort of was freeing to us because there was no you know, ambitious, you know, thoughts in our head, you know, like, oh, well, we'll take this to the masses or we'll bring blues music to the mainstream or anything like that. I mean, we never sent out demos to record labels or tried to get signed because we assumed that. I mean, how ridiculous it would be to walk in and say, well, yeah, me and my sister have this two-piece band, and we play, you know, sort of really raw blues music or rock and roll, and we're centered around the number three, and then we have everything revolving around childishness and these colorful notions. And then someone would have just, what are you talking about? You know, if we did that in 99 or something, that would have been hilarious.
Well, tell you what, why don't we do a tune, and we can talk some more. What do you guys want to start off with?
This song, Lord Send Me an Angel, this is a song Blind Willie McTell used to sing, and I sort of transferred it to my hometown, and I used it to talk about myself. I just changed to his location from Atlanta to Detroit.
I got Lord, I said, send me an angel down. Can't you spend no angel, or we'll spill your tears in brown. Oh, that's new, oh, I love it. I said, oh, man, I got it, must be best. Cause the Detroit women won't let Mr. Jack White rest. There was a crowd down on the corner. I said, I wonder what could it be. It wasn't a thing but the women just trying to get to me. I went down to the station, a suitcase in my hand. A crowd of women run crowds, and Mr. Jack, won't you be my man? So there was three women, and they were yellow, brown, and black. It took the mayor of Detroit to pick which one I like. One of them, Hamtramck yellow, one of them, Detroit brown. But it's out of dark skin, we should have turned my damper down. I used to say, married women, you're the sweetest women ever born. I'ma change that thing, you better leave married women alone. Well, they'll tell you that they love you their whole life. Grab a man on the corner and they tell that same lie twice. and I cannot be trusted. I can't be satisfied when the men sleep and come and start to pin the women to their side. And my baby, she's got a mojo. She tried to keep it in, but Jack White got something to find a little mojo with. And my mother once told me, when I was a boy playing Mumbly Peg, don't drink no white cow's milk and don't you eat no white hen's eggs. A black man will give you a dollar and he won't think it's nothing strange. A white man give you a dollar, expect back 95 cents change. So good long, a good long, send me an angel down. Can you spell no angel, you'll spell your tears in brown. But it's no way of loving, swear to God it's best, cause the Detroit women don't let Mr. Jack White rest.
Lord, Send Me an Angel, a version done today by the White Stripes, who are playing live for us today. And we get a chance to talk with Jack and Meg about that. Kind of leads me into something I really wanted to talk in depth with you about, which is country blues, and these personalities, these guys that I know you're big fans of, people like Robert Johnson and Son House. Did you discover them when you were a kid, or when did you first discover their music?
No, I didn't. I was completely ignorant of blues music growing up. I only knew rock and roll, and probably the closest thing I knew when I was, like, you know, 8 years old is, like, you know, someone told me the Lemon Song was, you know, a ripoff of some blues artist or something, and I'd say, oh, you know, and I didn't know what that meant or whatever. And I think at some point, when I was about 14 or 15, there was a Howlin' Wolf cassette, like the Best of Howlin' Wolf cassette, in my bedroom somehow or whatever. And I really started to get into that, like his song, Sitting on Top of the World. And I learned how to play that. And that was sort of the first blues song I learned how to play. You know, you go to the store and I bought like a Robert Johnson or a Son House record, and someone played me those, and it was like the whole world just blew up, you know. And that was, I seemed to want to abandon everything else I liked about music at that point. I didn't want to listen to any rock and roll for a while there. I just wanted to listen to nothing but this folk music. And I'd been listening to Bob Dylan and his early things, and coming off of all the old folk musicians he would been listening to, like, you know, you see like on the Smithsonian Anthology records, and all everything started to make sense, you know. And I started to want to know more and more about where the truth was. Instead of the followers for the last, you know, 40 years or 50 years or whatever it was, I just wanted to go down to where they were getting it from and where those guys were getting it from, and learning about that tradition, you know, all these songs that Robert Johnson were doing were the songs, same songs that people around him like Tommy Johnson and Son House were playing first. And then you just want to join that family, you know, and you just hope that family still exists, and these traveling minstrels of musicians around the world are there, instead of, you know, horrible white boy blues band in the bar in town or something, that there's actually people involved in there, some form of folk music, you know.
Well, tell you what, you want to move over to the piano and do one there?
Of course, yeah. I'll do this song is called I Want to Be the Boy to Warm Your Mother's Heart.
So scared to take you away. I try to win the rover, but from the start, but something always got in the way. I'm sitting in your backyard for hours, but you won't ever come out and say hi. My mother baked a little cake for you, and even dreaded when you said goodbye. What kind of compliments do I have to blow? What jokes don't I let them know? High school to make it known that I'm a brown. Nothing I come up with seems to work. It feels like everything I say is a lie. Never have I felt like such a jerk. I'm afraid to even open my eyes, cause I feel it don't want her to judge me. I want her to really know who I am, and then and within will she love me.
me. Well, at least that was the plan. If a boy needed a holiday and a girl needed someone old, I just hope I don't act the same way by the time that I get that old. And I get that old. Never said I was ahead of a fortune. I never claimed to have any looks. But these kind of things must be important. Cause somebody ripped out my page in your telephone book. I want a warm heart.
White Stripes are our guest today, and that's one that is on Elephant, the new one. This album, when it came out in April, I guess it came out on April Fool's Day, and I guess by April 2nd, people were calling it the album of the year. And now now we're coming to that time of year where people do
what
that.
What took them so long?
Yeah, exactly. Now we're coming to that time of year. You have said that in the past, and I'm wondering how this sits with you, about, you know, there's only a limited life to this band, and you, I think you said something about five albums at that time. Does that sit well with you as to how the band's progressing, or is there a lot more room for you to grow?
It's very hard for us to tell. We sort of were asked that a lot, because I think everyone, say when White Blood Cells came out, I think they started to get this mainstream attention. People were starting to say, oh, well, okay, it's good, but how long will it last? Mm-hmm. It's like, well, I don't know, maybe a couple more albums and we'll call it quits. And I didn't want to beat, you know, this into the ground, and neither does Meg, you know. And of course, when Elephant came out and it was another huge international smash hit success that we of course knew it was going to be, that people said, oh, well, how long can it last? I said, well, geez, how long do you want me to do, you know? What's for breakfast?
I totally see that. Well, let's talk about somebody who has a career that's lasted more than four albums. Let's talk about Loretta Lynn, because I know you all are big fans, and you dedicated the album to her.
Yeah.
But I understand you... you've had a chance to actually spend some time with her. What is she like? What does she think of your music? And how do you guys interact?
We've become just best friends. I love her so much, and we have a lot of affection for each other. And the thing she said about the, I think only the real comment that stood out in my mind about the White Stripes, she said, was that she heard, I guess he was at home, and someone put on the Seven Nation Army video was on TV. And she said, well, that sounds like someone breaking into a bank. I still don't know what that means, but I love that. Well, yeah, we've become really cool, and I was offered the opportunity to produce her new album, and we just finished that up recently, and I can't wait for it to come out. I mean, all the songs are all written by Loretta, and some of them are 30 years old that she never recorded. Some of them she wrote a few months ago, and... she's such a brilliant songwriter. She just blows my mind. I don't understand where the... She just has this cleverness in her head that you would swear when you talk to her that she's so funny. You'd swear that she would never think of these things, you know, but she thinks of these intricate little plays and relationship plays that are so bizarre that I just... It's like, wow, where did that come from? And, like, I can't believe that you know, even at her age, she still thinks these same things about, like, when people are, you know, teenagers in love, you know, she still has those same thoughts in her head. That's really, really inspiring to look forward to in my life.
It's encouraging. How do you, you know, as a producer, I would be intimidated. I mean, you don't want to get in the way of this, right? I mean, that's the kind of thing that would
Yeah, it's a kind of, sometimes it's very funny. Sometimes when you when we're doing things with people like that, a couple times we have, it's very funny how the sort of the ball ends up in our chord or my chord or whatever. Like say we did a set of Yardbird songs with Jeff Beck in England, and I called him, we're talking, I said, well, what do you want to do? What songs should we do? He's like, whatever you want to do is fine with me. So me and Meg were sitting there, and we had a couple days to practice, and I said, all right. So we picked like 10 or 12 songs that we liked by the Yardbirds, and we went there, and it's like, do you want to do this one? We rehearsed it with him. We only had like 2 hours to rehearse or something. We rehearsed it with him, and I said, well, do you want to do that one? He's like, yeah, if that's fine with me, you know, if you want to, yeah, sure. Sounds great. And it's kind of the same thing with Loretta Lynn. She's like, she had all these songs here, and she's like, I said, well, what's ones you really want to do, Loretta? And she's like, whichever ones you like, Jack, let's just do those, you know? Yeah. And it's really, it makes you intimidated because I don't feel like I have that sort of taste enough to know what they want to express or something like that. So it's a very difficult job to get a handle on it. You have to really connect with them, I guess, on those places.
No,
I don't know,
absolutely.
I'm talking too much about it. Sorry.
No, I think I would totally agree with that. Now, I'm interested about you and Jeff Beck. He would be a guitarist, and I would put on, you know, a list of people that their sounds that they get out of their instruments that you get out somewhat out of yours, too. Are there other people that you've looked to could take sounds from, take ideas from? Or, you know, rock and roll is stealing business, isn't it?
I suppose so, but it was a time when we started to play shows started to go to shows and see like garage rock bands in Detroit and stuff. And the thing that really upset me was that I didn't like when people on purpose ripped off old music and purposefully did that and then just changed the words and called it their own.
Mm-hmm.
And I would get disappointed, like I'd hear a riff or something by a band and I thought, that's so great. And then, you know, a couple months later I'd hear the song they stole it from. I'm like, oh man. And it would just disappoint me so much. And I thought, I'm never, ever going to do that. And no matter what, I mean, you're going to write songs and people are always going to say it sounds like something, it sounds like this or that, and that you can't avoid that. Well, there's no problem with that, having influences, but I always try to avoid purposefully stealing from other people, you know. But I never really had one, you know, sort of guitar player that I always looked up to and I wanted to be like them. There's always, I like little snippets of things here and there, like a different tone here on some old record or the way an amp sounded on this record or something like that. And I just try to, like, those things just kind of pop in my head. When I was a teenager, I was really got into Dexter Roundwimber from this band, the Flat Duo Jets. I was really not too crazy about his tone. I was just crazy about his attitude towards his guitar. The attitude was to not really care that much. And I was trying to balance that with the fact when I saw Detroit garage rock bands, a lot of them, I never saw a guitar player in Detroit really stand out. Like, if he did a guitar solo, like, pop above the band and break through the monotony of the riff and break out and do something like that. And that made me really concentrate on tone. So I was sort of balancing my attitude towards it and tone. It's like when you don't want to do something perfect, you know, it's trying to be like an anti-perfectionist, but you're really it's really perfect by not trying to be perfect, I guess.
Well, it's Flat Duo Jets are a great great example of somebody with that kind of an aesthetic too. And in some ways, I've been thinking about this. You are kind of a conservative rocker in a way. I mean, 8-track, analog, no computers. Is it all about sound, or is it, as you kind of expressed there, kind of about a philosophy of keeping things closer to the bone?
I suppose it's both. I think that when you have given the job to do something or you take on a task, being creative, you want to do the best way you can do it. If you're a painter, I suppose you'd want to find the best oil paints that suit what you were doing. So I think when I was like, I'm going to play guitar, I guess, what's the best amp I can find? Well, I like a silver tone amp. I like a Fender Twin Reverb. There's not really any better sounding amps than that. I've played a million of them, and I've never found anyone better. And those amps are 40 years old, you know? So why bother? The same thing with recording microphones, you know, recording tape and old or recording gear. I think they never really surpassed it, so there's really no point. I mean, if this sounded that good for Frank Sinatra or the Beatles or something, then there's really no point in trying to quote-unquote improve it. I've never been a gadget man. I've never had that sort of male mentality to just want to get the new toy, the brand new toy that came out, you know, just because it's new. Mm. It has some new little trick to it just because it's digital. It doesn't mean it's better, you know.
I've been reading something, I guess, when this album came out, that you were happier with this album than any album except for maybe your first. Was it just because that was the first and you really got the sound you wanted finally on a record then? Or
I think you never get that moment back. You know, you never get that moment you had when you were making their first record. I think the same thing when we made our first 45. There was an attitude there that you'll never get back. That's just something that first album, just the way it came out, it just, for me and Meg, it felt blessed to us because it was exactly what we wanted on tape. And you just never get that moment back. We never wanted to try to recreate it either. So it's just, it'll always be the best because it's always my favorite in my mind, you know.
So you want to do something from that first?
Yeah, we'll do, this song is called Big Three Kill My Baby, which I originally wrote for Andre Williams.
Really? Really?
But he wouldn't sing it, yeah.
Wow. We should maybe tell people just briefly who Andre Williams is, because he's a name you can't drop everywhere.
Oh, yeah. Well, he's an old sort of soul singer and producer from the 60s. He worked for Fortune Records, and he wrote the song Shake Your Tail Feather, and he produced the first version of Mustang Sally. And he worked with people back there in Detroit. He worked with Stevie Wonder a little bit, I think, early on, and Ike Turner a little bit. And I was in a band called Two Star Tabernacle for a short time, and we made 145 with him. And he said he wanted to do, I said, what song should we do? And Dan, the singer in the band, we were asking, what song should we do? And he said, oh, well, it's got to be controversial. And I said, what do you mean? He's like, well, you know, something like, well, what if I was gay? Would you love me anyway? Something like that. And so I went home and I just had this idea in my head about that. I wanted to write something against the car companies. And I said, oh, that'll work for what he was talking about maybe. So I wrote the Big Three Kill My Baby. And I showed him the lyrics and he's like, yeah, you sing it. And so we did a version and I sang it. And then he would just say, she's dead in the background over and over again. It was very funny. But I ended up not, it wasn't very country because it was a country band we were playing with. We wanted to make a country record, so it didn't work out. So I ended up popping up on the first White Stripes record.
Well, Andre's not here, but this is Big Three Killed My Baby.
These ideas make me wanna spit. $100 goes down the pit. 30,000 wheels are rolling. Yeah, my stick shift hands are swollen. Everything involved is shady. That big three killed my baby. Why don't you take the day off and try to repair? A billion others don't seem to care. Better my tears are stuck in the mud. The motor's running on Tucker's blood. Don't let them tell you the future's electric. The gasoline's not measured in metric. 30,000 wheels are spinning. The oil company faces are grinning. And now my hands are turning red. That's when I found out that my baby was dead. Meg, I've said it again, but nothing's changed. People are burning for pocket change. Their creative minds are lazy. That a big three kills your baby.
Big Three Killed My Baby, a live version from our World Cafe session today. The White Stripes for our Vintage Cafe.